I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe, Elena Scheim. She is Executive Director of Impact Personal Safety. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having us.
So we've had you on over the years a number of times because the work that Impact Personal Safety does is a real kind of, it's not only self-defense, but it's really awareness of violence, of oppression, of a whole range of anti-violence services. Is that sort of summing it up?
Absolutely. I think that we talk about self-defense so much because that's what we offer for the public. But the vast majority of the work that we do is in the school and is in earlier forms of prevention that's doing anti-bias and anti-bullying, those sorts of things that happen so that hopefully we never get to this moment.
Now, you have gotten funding to do a series of free classes for crime victims. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. How did that come about?
It's been a dream of ours for so long. We know that survivors, you know, well over half of our classes are made up of survivors, and we know how much those of us who have experienced violence get out of these classes. And so it's always been our dream that it would be valued in this way that we say we know that therapy is really critical oftentimes to people's healing and recovery. And we also know that for a lot of us, it's based in our body and there's symptoms of trauma that simply talking can't touch.
Right, right. And I think particularly for women, but certainly not only for women, there is a sense of powerlessness that comes from the fact that it's so hard to go through the world knowing how vulnerable you are, especially when something's happened to you.
It is. And, you know, I think in the symptoms of PTSD, there is certainly constant fear and hypervigilance. There's changed behavior oftentimes, like you're describing, and nightmares. I mean, there's so many things that are really, really impact our lives and we become accustomed to. And the hope is that by serving more people who are experiencing those things, that we can cut down on those symptoms of after an assault or after violence.
So if after an assault or after violence, you take a class that teaches you not only some of the verbal principles that are taught at Impact Personal Safety, but also some of the real, I mean, I took that class years ago, and there is this thing of using your body, learning to defend yourself, hitting this man who's dressed in a very protected foam suit of some kind. And that in itself brings up so much emotion. It can, I imagine, be quite healing, is it?
It is. What, you know, we have a number of graduates who have said that their impact class, they were able to do what in 20 hours, what 10 years of therapy couldn't do.
Oh my goodness. Now tell us, okay, help us understand that.
Well, I think one of the pieces that we just forget because we get really divorced from mind and body, all of those things, you know, we think that so much of the healing has to be done just inside of the mind. And the reality is that in our classes, while there is strikes, there's verbal strategies, there's all of those things, one of the fundamental things that is just at the base of it is learning how to be in a scary situation and have all of these emotions that come up and learning how to regulate your own body and learning how to regulate your breathing and your response to fear and your response to trauma. And that regulation, you know, you absolutely can do it in forms of yoga and all of the other ways that we know are very popular in Santa Fe especially. But when we do it in actually a situation that has a lot of the same symptoms, signs, all of those things as to what made our reactions be so hard in the first place, we actually can do healing in a really different way.
There is something about what you just said, regulating your response in a moment of fear, that on the one hand may sound totally counterintuitive, like when you go into a place of fear, your instincts kick in. But in fact, I think that's what a lot of warrior training is about, what a lot of martial arts training is about, is to what to do when you are in a situation that's horrifyingly scary, as opposed to how to learn not to be fearful. I think everyone's right. fearful.
Yeah. There's a whole myth that fear goes away, and it just doesn't. And adrenaline never goes away. It's about managing our responses to it and using that adrenaline and that reaction to our advantage. And when that comes into our bodies, you know, I think of adrenaline like an old friend that when it enters my body, I'm like, oh, hi, it's nice to see you. I know what happens when you're around. So we're going to do these things now versus just being totally shocked when that happens, which is completely understandable, but not that useful for most of us.
Do you really feel that way? Like when something, I don't know what moment, but like describe what that might be like for you in a given moment in your day.
Gosh, I think that when I notice adrenaline coming up, it's not just in situations of violence or conflict or threat, although it certainly happens with that. I think of near misses with car accidents.
For example,
of public speaking. I think of talking with bill collectors. And when that, any of those things happen and I feel that adrenaline rush, it's rather than taking me off guard and really throwing me off, I can say, oh, I know what's happening now. I've experienced this before. And now I'm going to go into my steps of managing it rather than completely unraveling.
I think there's something really powerful about that, not only as a practice, but as something to think about because, you know, the adrenaline response obviously is a part of our evolutionary heritage mm-hmm. where if you were about to be attacked by right. a rhinoceros or some large right. animal or whatever, you're going to be adrenalized, and that's very adaptive.
Mm-hmm.
In office politics, it's not adaptive.
Right. Or school settings where a teacher is telling a student that they need to do better. Any of those situations, exactly. If we're having an adrenaline response and we're shifting from the thinking part of our brain to the reptilian, just reacting part of our brain, which is very functional, you're right, it's not useful in those moments. And meanwhile, we don't want it to go away entirely because that adrenaline response saves our lives so
yeah.
many times.
And some people seek it out. Mm-hmm. They surf big waves mm-hmm. or jump out of airplanes mm-hmm. or whatever.
And one of the things that I think is true oftentimes is youth who enjoy adrenaline oftentimes get in trouble because they are more risk-seeking than others. And the reality that we talk about with a lot of those youth is, who do you think staffs the ER rooms? Who do you think saves people's lives? Who do you think is a firefighter? There's so many professions where actually really good adrenaline management and not being averse to adrenaline is really critical.
Right. I mean, I guess if you're going to go into ER medicine or emergency medical technician,
mm-hmm.
it's a different kind of thing. And if you're going to be a dermatologist.
Exactly. You have to have fine motor skills, which go out the window when you're adrenalized. You have to be able to think clearly in those moments. And you have to be okay with that rush. Whereas I think a lot of us, you know, some people love roller coasters and all of these things like you're saying. And others of us are like, no, thanks. That's fine. I don't need to do that. And so we really need this variety of, you know, I don't know quite what word to call it, but these physiological and psychological responses to adrenaline, actually, it's really useful as a society, if you think about it, that we have such different relationships with adrenaline.
It's true. It lasted about 2 hours, but it was a very obsessive 2 hours of watching about 67 YouTubes of people who surf large waves.
Oh, uh-huh.
Both men and women.
Sure.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you ever want to look this up for yourself, it's absolutely stunning. Because usually you just see like the good rides, but what you see in these videos is people wiping out.
Yeah.
And the fear that I felt just watching right. these things,
right.
not to mention, but then you realize these people, because then they're interviewed. They are so tough because they know the difference between real danger
mm.
and office politics danger
mm.
or
mm-hmm.
bill collector danger.
Mm-hmm.
One
mm-hmm.
is life and death. Mm-hmm. The other is something I can deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I don't think it's ever about giving us perspective necessarily, simply as being able to manage the different situations that come up and being able to manage our responses to it in a way that works for us in our lives. You know, I think that it's tricky to avoid blaming people for their reactions in these situations because we never want to do that. It's never any of our faults. We have a whole, most of us have a whole history of things that have happened to us that were out of our control and weren't our fault, and therefore we have reactions to these moments that stemming from that. And that's nothing to blame anyone for. And meanwhile, many of us would like to have better skills to deal with our lives and to navigate our lives in ways that feel positive. And I think that's what this is about.
We're talking to Elena Scheim of Impact Personal Safety. So when people come in, crime victims, to classes that you're giving at Impact, what can they expect? What happens in these trainings?
Yeah, so these are all self-defense classes that are called empowerment-based self-defense. That's the style that we teach. And so what that means is we're not just teaching physical skills, which is what most people think about, but we're also teaching verbal strategies, we're talking about body language, we're talking about communication. And all classes, because we know so many of us are survivors that take the class, that it's really critical that we talk about what we're going to do beforehand. We have a space to talk about any concerns or ways we can make the experience better. And then everything we do, we show it, we drill it, and then students are asked to do it. So that's really critical, because one of the features of trauma is being really concerned about things surprising us,
yeah,
and not being ready for them. So there's a lot of ways that we do what's called trauma-informed practices to try to make the classes as safe as possible.
So a class for a whole group of crime victims, mm-hmm, might be framed just a little bit differently from a class for the general public?
Actually, what's neat about that is that when you make a class trauma-informed, that's good for everyone,
yeah,
right? For someone who doesn't have any history of trauma to walk in, or for a young person who's never had a history of trauma, we all like to know what's coming. We all like to be able to talk before we are asked to do something so that we feel like we're opting in rather than suddenly being pushed into something we might not feel ready for. And so these classes are actually, they're open to the public, and they're so someone can take the class that is a paying student or on our regular sliding scale,
oh, okay,
that hasn't experienced crime, whereas somebody else might be in the class that's experienced crime and is getting it supported by this funding.
One of the things that I remember about those classes is that there is a lot of there is a lot of effort put into teaching people how to diffuse potentially volatile situations with another person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's ways of saying no, what would you say, firmly but unaggressively? I'm not sure exactly what terminology,
yeah,
you would use.
We talk about the difference between assertiveness and passiveness and aggressiveness.
Yeah.
And so what we really want is that middle situation where truly people who are violent are looking for something to manipulate. And so we really don't want to give them anything to work with. Again, with putting all of the responsibility on them and the fact that I can't control their behavior, but with that piece of saying, here are the things that I know that can make me feel strongest in this situation, can diminish my risk, can help their response, and can also help if there's anyone around and I do have to defend myself in any sort of way, so that they can be very clear that it was self-defense and it wasn't me being aggressive.
Right, right. Now, if somebody is a potential perpetrator of a crime against somebody,
mm-hmm,
and they come across somebody who they think is going to be a potential victim, but it's actually an Impact Personal Safety graduate,
mm,
who then says that kind of firm and assertive but not aggressive no, and adopts the body posture of self-defense and uses their words and all of that stuff, and that person and the situation is diffused,
mm-hmm,
and that person goes away,
mm-hmm,
do you have any information about whether that person then goes and seeks out another victim, or are they kind of like taken aback? Like, what happens to them? Does it just mean that the next victim, the next block over, is in danger?
Right. I think that's a really common question. And I think one of the things that's really critical to keep as a part of the dialogue is that the vast majority of crime and violence aren't necessarily one-to-one, right? So what we focus on when we talk about prevention is mostly around violence, not around DWIs, for instance, whereas people who have experienced and been victimized by DWIs can take this class. So the funding is actually much wider in scope than what we're teaching prevention skills for, so just to say that. But I think one of the things that we're talking about is that most violence happens by someone that we know. And so when we're having these conversations, one of the things that we talk about is, you know, if somebody's in a situation and they go on a date with someone and that date doesn't go well and that person doesn't really respect their boundaries, there start to be these early warning signs of, no, this is not going to go how I like. And furthermore, these are actually signs of someone that could escalate in their behavior. And many of our graduates say, I decided not to go on a second date. And that was a huge success.
Right.
And I think the things that people who are violent or manipulative actually learn in those moments is, oh, I'm going on a lot of first dates and I'm not going on a second date. Maybe I need to change my behavior. You know, when we talk about violence, one of the things that we know, and this is something we work on in our other impact programs that aren't self-defense even more, is that social norm theory and the fact that we all learn what's okay and what's not okay by social feedback. And so it's really critical to do that early on so that people learn what's okay and what's not okay, especially when it comes to gender-based violence.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, even people who are adults are still learning if their friends are going, man, that joke wasn't, that wasn't actually funny. And no, I don't want to go on another date with you. You didn't listen to me. And so I do think there is this feedback loop that obviously we want to do it as early as possible, but at the same time still is happening later on in life for people.
And really, that's the most profound kind of social change that takes place when everybody in a group says, dude, are you crazy? As opposed to, wow, dude, that's great.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that happens in the classes that, again, it's more apparent in our earlier classes, but actually that we're doing social norm change in self-defense classes when we all as a class say, oh, wow, it's not okay when people act like that. It's not our fault when people act like that. If somebody is victimized, when that happens, it's actually the perpetrator's fault. All of those things are things that we know are what's called rape myths and really serve perpetrators. And so when we have a whole class where we're forming a community that says, that's not okay and that's not your fault, if that happens, that's actually creating change too.
So I think the key words there are forming a community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole community and sort of a culture that has grown up around this kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that I know is that after someone takes a class, whether it's a one-day class or a four-day class, they've had exposure to all these different things, and they've had lots of people over and over saying, this isn't okay, violence isn't okay, someone talking to you like that isn't okay. And then we go back into the rest of the world, and either we're around people who are saying over and over again, yep, you're right, that's not okay, or we're around people that are saying, why did you say that? He didn't mean anything by it.
Right.
Why did you take it so personally? And so it is about making that community larger and larger that says, nope, violence is never okay. It's never a victim's fault.
Yeah.
And we all believe that. And so that we just make that bigger and bigger. And there's a lot of us in the community that are working on that. We have lots of partners in the community that are all working on that belief change.
It reminds me a little bit of the problem that people have when they've been alcoholics and then they stop drinking and they have to look at the fact that their community is still full of drinkers and find a community of people who are doing sobriety or who aren't problem drinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And that often means really shifting where you spend your time and who your friends are.
It does. And I think it also means, you know, most of us, we don't just want personal safety. We want community safety. And so it also means how are we willing and how are we ready to show up to be active allies and bystanders and actually use the strength that we've cultivated to be able to call other people in. And so I know for myself, and I know this is true for many of our students, that actually the verbal strategies and those skills and that adrenaline management, I've used not only to advocate for myself, but when somebody tells a joke about a group that doesn't even affect me, it means that I'm able to use my voice and say, hey, that's not okay. And do you know that people are actually targeted for violence based on people thinking that it's okay to joke about these things and that no one's going to do anything about it?
Does that happen to you in real life?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And it's one of the things that we teach in our anti-bias and anti-bullying programs. One of the things that we're teaching is the skills to speak up for ourselves, but then the skills to speak up for others and support others who are being targeted and victimized. Because once you have skills, it never stops there, right? It's not just about self-liberation and freedom. It's always about community. And so that's really critical. But I think oftentimes when we talk about bystander intervention and helping, we never think about not just the belief that it's important to do so, but actually I need the skills to do that. So if I can't speak up for myself, there's no way I'm going to look across the room or across a parking lot and go, wow, that looks really scary. I'm going to go over there.
Right.
Right. I need to have those skills myself.
Elena Scheim is Executive Director of Impact Personal Safety. They're on the web at impactpersonalsafety.org. And as we've been talking about, there is funding now for free classes for victims of crime. And you don't have to have had like a police report or whatever. If you check a box saying you've been a crime victim, then you can take a free class. If people want more information, not only impactpersonalsafety.org, but also the phone number over there is 992-8833 here in the 505 area code. Elena, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.